Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Rick Bragg says he thinks he's best at writing about people in trouble, about misery, about crack-infested high-rises, welfare hotels, and natural disasters. He's now based in Atlanta and writes about the South for the New York Times. He grew up in rural Alabama. His parents separated before he was born. His mother was poor and didn't buy a new dress for 18 years so that her children could have school clothes. In fact, although she often thinks of herself as a failure, Bragg thinks she's responsible for a lot of his success. Much of his new memoir is about her. It's called All Over But the Shoutin'. Here's a short reading about growing up in the South, surrounded by natural beauty, but living in poverty.
It was as if God made them pay for the loveliness of their scenery by demanding everything else. Yet the grimness of it faded for a while, at dinner on the ground at the Protestant churches, where the people sat on the springtime grass and ate potato salad and sipped sweet tea from an aluminum tub with a huge block of ice floating in it. The pain eased at family reunions where the men barbecued 24 hours straight, and the women took turns holding babies and balancing plates on their knees, trying to keep the grease from soaking through on the one good dress they had. The hardness of it softened in the all-night gospel singings that ushered in the dawn with the promise that, "I'll have a new body, praise the Lord, I'll have a new life." As babies crawled up into the ample laps of grandmothers to sleep across jiggling knees. If all else failed, you could just wash it away for a little while, at the stills deep in the woods or in the highly illegal beer joints and the so-called social clubs, where the guitar pickers played with their eyes closed, lost in the booze and the words of lost love and betrayal. They sang about women who walked the hills in long black veils of whispering pines and trains. It was the backdrop and the soundtrack of our lives. I was born into it in the summer of 1959, just in time to taste it, absorb it, love it, and hate it, and know its secrets. When I was a teenager, I watched it shudder and gasp and finally begin to die. The pines clear-cut into huge patches of muddy wasteland and the character of the little towns murdered by the generic subdivisions and generic fast-food restaurants. The South I was born in was eulogized by pay-as-you-pray TV preachers, enclosed in a coffin of light blue aluminum siding and laid to rest in a polyester suit from Walmart.
Rick Bragg refers to pay-as-you-pray preachers in that reading. Later in his memoir, he explains that his mother used to gather the children around the TV Sunday mornings to watch the televangelists. I asked Bragg about his impressions of those shows.
One thing that you will absolutely get shot for where I grew up is making fun of anybody's religion. And for people who couldn't afford to go to church, or believe me, there are people who can't afford to go to church. For people who didn't want to go for a lot of reasons, these preachers brought the word into their living rooms. And my mom liked to hear it. I think it was comforting to her. She liked to hear the singing. I think it was a connection for her. For my brothers and I, it was alternating torture, and we didn't want to be sitting in front of a television listening to a TV preacher. We wanted to be running around outside throwing rocks at each other. But she didn't really make us, but she would bribe us. For instance, she would cook up a great breakfast on Sunday, and we knew that to get that great breakfast, we were going to have to listen to a little preaching.
Did your mother have any interest in going to an actual church, or were you very far away from it?
Well, as I said in the book, my mom was very, very proud. My mom, gave everything that she had to us, and she never really had church clothes. And I think she had interest, and I think she may yet go someday again, but she has been, later in life, but it's one of those things that I don't talk a whole lot to my mom about because I think it's intensely personal. About two or three times a decade, she'll preach to me a little bit, and I listen to it and see some value in what she's saying. She's just trying to keep me from going to hell in a handbasket, that's all. But it's a personal thing to her, and we just don't talk a lot about it.
You write some about your father in this book, and your father was a drunk and often a brute, and he and your parents were separated by the time you were born. He didn't even come to see you till you were nearly 2 years old. You say in his world, strength and toughness were everything, and that it was common, acceptable, not to be able to read, but a man who wouldn't fight, who couldn't fight, that was a pathetic thing. To be afraid was shameful. Now, you did read. You loved to read and read quite well, but how did you measure up in that other category of fighting?
Oh, I read and fought, too. I'm no kind of Renaissance man, but I had fist fights in the parking lot of the Hardee's hamburger joint and had fist fights on the playground at Roy Webb Elementary and Williams Junior High School, and I won some of them, and I lost a bunch of them. It might not be very progressive, but if somebody insults you, however they insult you down there, you're expected to knock them down.
Well, you say your father taught you that if you're playing baseball and the batter got a hit off of you, then you should throw the next pitch at his head.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when your father taught you something like that, did you think, oh, yes, well, I'd better do just that?
Oh, yeah, and you got to understand, I was 5 or 6, you know. I mean, we were playing with plastic bats or with tree limbs, and he, you know, and he thought that was perfectly acceptable. And I did it. I did it later in life, too. The reason that I included that passage in the book is because I had just come back from 6 months in New York, and I remembered how on such a regular basis there would be a cuss fight on a street corner, you know, between a vendor and someone who shortchanged him or just, you know, these, you know, people screaming at each other face to face. Well, that just doesn't happen where I come from. It doesn't happen. If somebody insults you or if someone screams at you and you're of their gender, then you knock them on their ass. And seems a whole lot more civilized to me than standing screaming obscenities at each other. But I'm getting old now, and it hurts a lot, so I try to avoid it when I can.
I'm wondering how your home life has affected the kind of stories you gravitate to as a reporter. And you write in your book that you write mostly about people in trouble, about misery.
I think it gave me an understanding of it. When I sit in the living room of someone who is obviously a little embarrassed to have you sitting there, you know, on their furniture, a little embarrassed to have you, you know, standing in their kitchen and a bug goes across the floor. I wish sometimes I could just tell them, and often I do tell them, that I grew up just like this, and I understand it, and I'm not going to treat it like I'm on some kind of safari. I mean, the one thing I've always thought I was pretty good at was writing about these folks, and I think it is because I understand them. There's not that much difference in growing up in a little bitty house out in the country and growing up in a housing project in New Orleans or Memphis or Birmingham. It's the same level of poverty. It's just different flavors of it. And I admit that I cut folks a great deal of slack. I don't romanticize poverty. There's nothing romantic about being poor. But there is dignity in it, and some of the most dignified people I've ever met had their toes poking through their shoes. And I think a lot of reporters who didn't grow up poor, still, you know, they have the same compassion and understanding for it. They just approach it from a different way. I don't think I'm any better at it than anybody else. The difference is that if someone rushes over and closes the door to their kitchen when you walk into their little bitty apartment or maybe it's a project or a house, I kind of understand why they do that. They don't want you to see the level of how poor they are.
How old were you when you started to read newspapers?
I think I probably started to read them when I was 8 or 9. I would read the sports page. We didn't take a paper. The local paper was a weekly, the Jacksonville News. and we would get it a few days late. You know, a paper would go to one person's house, and they'd read it, and then they'd come over to your house to bring you some tomatoes or cucumbers or something, and they'd bring the paper. And that's how the paper would get passed around. We got a lot of use out of that paper. when I was probably 11 or 12, 13, and started, you know, playing sports badly, I wanted to read the sports page, and I read the sports page of the Anniston Star, which is a great small newspaper in Northeast Alabama. It's in my home county. And I didn't read the editorial page, and I didn't read the front page, but I would read the sports page and the comics. And the sports writing that I read was really beautifully written, and it really evoked these images of the games and these heroes. And I think I fell in love with it partly because of that.
Well, Rick Bragg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No, it's my pleasure. It was fun.
Rick Bragg writes about the South for the New York Times. His new memoir is called All Over But the Shoutin'.